talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, how the first English travellers in India encountered an unimaginable superpower and how their meetings would change the world. We'll also be debating the impact of the brutish empire over four centuries, and to end the show, the Irish Revolution in Dublin. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. We begin tonight's show with the travellers in the Golden Realm, as we find out how Mughal India connected England to the world. Before the East India Company and before the British Empire, England was a pariah state. Seeking better fortunes, 16th and 17th century merchants, pilgrims and outcasts ventured to the kingdom of the mighty Mughals. And a new book drawing on rich original sources traces the origins of a relationship between two nations, one outsider and one superpower, whose cultures remain inextricably linked to this day. The book is called Travellers in the Golden Realm. It's published in hardback by John Murray. The author is Lubaba Al-Azami. And Lubaba, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So talk to me about these travellers in the Golden Realm. Talk to me about the Golden Realm, but also this idea about England being a pariah state.
Yes. So, I mean, I wrote this book really because when we think of England and India, usually we think of empire, usually we think of the British Raj, company rule, and, you know, essentially that particular period. But there was near two centuries of history prior to that, which hasn't been discussed as much, hasn't been explored as much. And that's sort of what brought this book together. And that was the period during the Renaissance when England was just reeling from its from basically being thrown out by the Catholic Church under the reign of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. And so England became a pariah state for much of Europe, which was Catholic. And so it was seeking alternate trade partners and military partners and diplomatic partners in this period, sort of primarily the 17th century is what I'm looking at. And so it was in this context that England, one of the nations that it reached out to was Mughal India, particularly for trade. And Mughal India in this period was one of the wealthiest empires in the world at this point. It was the wealthiest just short of Ming China. By 1700, it had outstripped Ming China. So in that sense, it was a very, very different political dynamic. And so we see that emerging in the sort of travellers that travel there and the kind of experiences they had in Mughal India. And that's pretty much what I'm covering in this book.
And in many ways, it has kind of been a forgotten history because the history tends to focus on the area of imperialism rather these dynamics.
Absolutely. And this is something that really struck me, that we've really focused on the colonial history, which tells a very particular narrative of who has authority towards having power, who has authority to be able to take certain advances, to be able to also engage in certain violences. Whereas this history, it's an extensive history. It's not even a scattered history. It's extensively documented. It's a lengthy period, almost equal to the British Empire itself. The British Empire was almost two centuries. This one is also almost two centuries. So it really is a forgotten history, but also a neglected history. It felt that, you know, it's right there. Why has no one written on this before? Why are we not talking about it before? And that's the sort of discussions I'm trying to raise here.
And the decision to seek trade with India, it marks a pivot away from Europe-centric diplomacy. And even though they arrive as minor players, they soon become significant.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was this. I mean, the Renaissance is a period which I see as England and Western Europe's global birth. And of course, this period was when Columbus voyaged across the Atlantic seeking India and stumbled across the Americas. This was the period in which Vasco da Gama, the Portuguese explorer, managed to secure and basically trace the first maritime route direct to India. So these were the two sort of biggest navigational expeditions that took place in this period. Of course, you've also got the circumnavigations of the globe going on. But this really was a period of Western Europe's global birth. And England was really invested in that. In large part because it had been sort of rejected by Catholic Europe because of its shift to Protestantism through the Reformation. So England was very much taking this global turn. And so it went to India. And the English arrived in India very much as essentially people from the equivalent of a modern day developing nation reaching one of the advanced nations of the world. But what it did do, what that sort of back foot did do was teach them to be pragmatic, to find alternative ways of securing that foothold, and it basically sort of fueled Britain's global turn, because engaging with India required interacting with wider global networks as well, with East Africa and West Africa and Indonesia and China. So it sort of further spurred England's global birth, and that's really one thing that when I talk about how Mughal India connected England to the world, and that's the subtitle of the book, that's part of what I'm talking about. That inverted political dynamic really propelled England in its global connections.
And the slave trade is another of those connections. And
yes.
We see the discussion of the foundations and the future of the transatlantic slave trade, and also the Indian Ocean slave trade.
Absolutely. And this was another, while I was researching this book, and I sort of worked on this book over a period of 4 years, I was working through sort of primary source material, and I wanted to work on the transatlantic slave trade because inevitably maritime trade networks were interconnected. So I anticipated that there would be quite a lot of connection with the transatlantic slave trade. You know, this is a whole network of English trading companies, and there's often overlap. What I didn't anticipate was sort of unearthing a huge slave trading, European-led slave trading network in the Indian Ocean as well. We're a lot more aware of the transatlantic slave trade. We should be aware of it. We should be more aware of it and talking about it more. This was a really dark period in our history, but I feel that we need to talk about the slave trade in its global realities as well. Europe did not only engage in it in the Atlantic, they also engaged in it in the Indian Ocean. And there was lots of overlap between the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean slave trade. So if I give you an example of the scale of European slave trading in the Indian Ocean, the Dutch enslaved twice as many people in the Indian Ocean than they did in the Atlantic slave trade. So some 1.1 million people from the 17th to the 19th century, they trafficked throughout the Indian Ocean Basin. And of course, the East India Company was very much involved in this as well. So the East India Company, even prior to the Royal African Company's foundations in the 1660s, the East India Company traded people from West Africa onto the Indian Ocean Basin, but also traded people within the Indian Ocean Basin, particularly in partnership with the Dutch. Whereas when the Royal African Company came into being, then the East India Company started trading people from the Royal African Company to bring into the Indian Ocean. So it was very much another dark element of this period, was this extension of the slave trade into the Indian Ocean, and a really a proliferation of this trade in that space as well. And so I have a chapter that focuses on that, chapter 12. And that was in some ways, you know, perhaps the most difficult chapter to write, because it's a very violent history. So, again, another area of this history that I hope people will talk about more.
And is there a sense that the English and then later the British, they misunderstood or sometimes deliberately distorted the caste-based systems of labour so that they could develop their own systems of slavery and servitude?
I mean, I think the East India Company's role in enslavement in this period and in this area is different to the transatlantic slave trade, in that the transatlantic slave trade enslavement of people was the primary commerce, so to speak, whereas in the Indian Ocean it was not as mature in that sense, so in terms of like shifting labor and shifting sort of the networks of that period. But what the East India Company and its fellow European competitor companies did do was consolidate the networks of trade in the period in the region. There were previous more fragmentary networks of trade that indigenous local communities did engage in, but the Europeans came, really consolidated it, expanded the structures of it. And so in East India Company records, for example, we'll see cases where they'll talk about Madras being a point where plenty of Indian enslaved people would pass through the East India Company fort onto the Dutch factories. So they'd be part of this sort of transitional network. So it was less sort of the primary trade for the East India Company. East India Company's primary trade was more in spices and textiles, but it was very much part of what they did. And they certainly consolidated the networks of trade in this period.
There are some really remarkable and quite formidable women in the book as well. And we have empresses, we have a queen mother, princesses, and some quite significant women in terms of ruling different areas.
Yes. Yeah, so what I was quite keen on was to present a history that gives the multiplicity of voices. So it gives Indian voices, gives English voices, but also gives the multiplicity of voices in terms of gender. Often history can, particularly of this period, can be sort of weighted towards male voices. And particularly in the English relationship with India, there were lots of very powerful, influential, impactful women who are part of the discussion. So, for example, one person I focus on is Empress Nur Jahan. She was the chief consort of the Emperor Jahangir, who was Mughal India's fourth ruler. And Nur Jahan pretty much governed as co-sovereign with Jahangir. She was recognized as co-sovereign. One of the things that she did, which is the sole prerogative of the emperor, but she did it as well, was mint coins in her name. So that in the region, that was something only the ruler had the prerogative to do, but she did it as well. And she also issued decrees. And she was someone who was she was politically involved in governance of the Mughal state, but she was also very much involved in international trade. So in addition to owning ships herself and sort of building networks of caravanserais or along overland trade networks, she was also someone who was very much involved in England's negotiations for a trade partnership with India. So, for example, in 1615, we have the first English ambassador to India comes, Sir Thomas Rowe. And it was Nur Jahan who basically told Thomas Rowe that your enterprise is under my aegis. And so Thomas Rowe pretty much spent his four-year embassy trying to appeal to the queen. He thought he'd be appealing to the king, but he really spent the entire four-year embassy trying to appeal to the queen and secure her good favors in order to secure a trade agreement, which he ultimately never did. He never was able to appeal to her sufficiently. But Nur Jahan is one figure who was hugely influential. And we also have several cases of Indian women who marry English and European men. So another example who I bring up is someone called Mariam Khan. She was a ward of the Emperor Jahangir from his household, and she married the first East India Company captain to travel to India, William Hawkins. And she actually travelled back to London via Ireland and spent time in London. And you know, William Hawkins passed away, and then she married another East India Company captain. So again, really interesting figures and really interesting women who undertake really quite significant roles within this history of England and India.
And some very interesting travellers from England who then wrote accounts and made some very significant contributions to helping people understand. One man wrote a Crudities, that was the title,
yes.
Is a Coryat's Crudities and humorous and detailed travelogues, and these became publishing sensations. And they're writings that introduced cultural innovations to England as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So Thomas Coryat, as you say, also Thomas Rowe, as I mentioned, what was great about these English travellers to India is that they like to keep records of their travels. East India Company factors and traders, and particularly the more senior people, were sort of required to keep records. But as you say, there was this one really fascinating figure, Thomas Coryat, who was essentially England's first tourist in India. Now, being a tourist in this period in India, it takes some going, because it takes a certain kind of mad person to be willing to take that deadly voyage that takes some 9 months to reach India all the way from England, Tom. And so most people do it with that impetus of we're going to go trade and we're going to make a whole lot of money while doing it. Thomas Coryat decided he's going to walk to India overland, and he's going to just go and have a look at the place and ride an elephant. Now Thomas Coryat, he had form. He was a sort of unofficial court jester in the court of Prince Henry, the son of King James. And he'd done this sort of tour in Europe in 1608, which emerged in, as you say, this volume, Coryat's Crudities, which was sort of a volume recording his travels across Europe. I mean, this person is also, he's credited with introducing the fork and the umbrella to England as part of his European travels. And then in 1612, he decides to do the same thing in India. He decides, I walked across Europe. My book was a bestseller, so I'm going to go do this in India as well. So he sets off in 1612, reaches 1615, and he spends a couple of years in India. And among the things that he documents, which is particularly fascinating and that I write about as well, is he spends, he's a chameleon. He goes through different lands. He picks up languages. He picks up clothes. He picks up cultural habits. And so in India, he also picked up, he made a point of spending 6 months studying Persian, which was the official language of India, the sort of the state language. And then he goes and has an audience with Jahangir and manages to secure a bag of cash out of it. So it's really quite interesting. This, his account is especially fascinating because he's someone who is just really eccentric. He's energetic. He's really lovable in the way he sort of conducts these travels. And so he's just one of these figures. We've got lots of these mercenary type figures who emerge, who want to go there to make money, who engage in insider trading and this kind of stuff. But Coryat is this really quirky and fun character who engages India in all its cultural variety. He learns he wears their clothing, he eats their food, he learns their languages. And then he writes about it. He writes about it back in England, and then people get to consume India, because in this time, obviously, it's not so easy to travel that fast. And so travel writing becomes really, really popular. And so he sort of transports these cultural experiences back to England, where people consume it. And, you know, these writings survive to this day. That's how popular it was.
You end the book by talking about the accidental empire. And is there a sense that Britain was able to benefit from the Mughal empire being in decline, and it was maybe perhaps more opportunism than any clear, deliberate policy?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that, again, that struck me while I was doing this research, you know, that in colonial history writing, say 19th century, the really sort of peak colonial period history writing, there is this discourse of, and it continues into the 20th century, 21st century. There are some historians who push for this kind of narrative that there is an inevitability of Britain conquering these lands, you know, and you get the sort of Edward Said style Orientalism of these lands are barbaric, they're backward. Britain came as a civilizing nation, and inevitably they became rulers of this land. When you look at the history, it's simply not the case. Now, what I do want to stress is that once Britain became sort of attained that colonial foothold, it was all very, very intentional. The colonial project was very intentional, and it was expanded and continued. But when England first reached India, which is the story that I'm telling, when they first reached India in the late 16th century and the early 17th century, the impetus was solely trade. And it was in part solely trade because there was no hope or no prayer of going anywhere beyond that. England was very much a struggling island nation, literally an island. We'd just been cut off from Europe, but also India was one of the most powerful empires in the world. So even the thought of that was quite ludicrous. And we see that in English writings, that they're quite explicit that we are only here for trade. We don't have any aspirations towards anything else. And this is something we see quite explicitly in Thomas Rowe, the ambassador's writings. But what we see happen in sort of the 18th century, particularly in the early period, is that the last and most effective Mughal emperor, Alamgir I, he dies in 1707, and there isn't a really suitable successor after him. So the Mughals go into a very rapid decline after that. And that includes invasions from the Persians, that includes sort of their various regions sort of breaking away into breakaway states, internal infighting. It's quite a difficult period for the Mughal Empire. And so it was sort of these circumstances that the English had literally no hand in. These were sort of internal affairs of the Mughal Empire and its own decline that precipitated and enabled England's rise within the region. So then by the sort of mid-18th century, England manages to get its first foothold in Bengal in the Battle of Plassey. Now that would not have been conceivable 50 years prior, but in that very short period, England, Mughal India went into a very rapid decline, and England managed to take advantage of that. And thereafter, it continued and developed accordingly in a very intentional manner. But really, it was an accidental empire in the sense that, you know, when England arrived, there was no notion of empire. For a century and a half, at least, that continued. And it was only in sort of the early 18th century, when the Mughals themselves went into decline, that any prospect of gaining a foothold sort of emerged.
Well, it's a fascinating new study. The book is called Travellers in the Golden Realm, subtitled How Mughal India Connected England to the World. It's published in hardback by John Murray. And my thanks to the author, Lubaba Al-Azami, for joining me tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. For centuries, a small island nation cast a shadow across the world. The British Empire's methods of expansion were often brutal, usually devastating. With many nations worldwide still grappling with the legacy of British rule, a new book explores the justifications used to dehumanise other people and rationalise their abuse, exploitation and slaughter. The book is called The Brutish Empire, Four Centuries of Colonial Atrocities. It's published in paperback by the O'Brien Press. The author is Des Eakin. And Des, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Good to be back.
Can I begin with the title, The Brutish Empire? Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant play on the name British Empire.
Well, I've always been a sucker for bad puns, but there's more to this than just a bad pun. For a start, I wanted to distance the British nation of today, the vibrant multicultural state, our nearest neighbours, good friends, rivals on the sports field, with this horrendous entity that ruled much of the world. I wanted to try and get away to separate the two, because on the one hand, British means something like nasty, often violent. And that is a good way of describing how the British Empire operated. I mean, it's very hard to find other words to describe an empire that enslaved 3.1 million people. Forced them to work to death on the in the plantations. Other things like that, went to war over the right to sell narcotics to the Chinese. But there's also an element to that. I wanted to reference George Orwell's belief that colonialism brutalizes the oppressors as much as it does the victims, that it traumatizes the people who are actually committing these atrocities. And Orwell famously said once that British occupation of India could only be justified by the most brutal of arguments. So it's a reference to that as well. Also, just a little closing of the circle, because just a minor thing, but one of the first English colonisers in Ireland back in the 1500s described the Irish as the most barbarous and brutish, quote, nation on earth. So there's a sense of a sort of closing of a circle there, if nothing else.
When we think of the dominant powers in the world today, Russia, the United States, China, they all have a huge landmass and they all have large populations. Mm. But when we go back in time and look at the British Empire, you know, Britain itself is quite a small island. Its population wasn't enormous. So yet, how was it able to gain such control and such influence all around the world?
Well, that's a great question. And that's the thing that fascinated me most about the British Empire, is just how it existed at all. I mean, how a small island of the unfashionable northern suburbs of Europe managed to get to the stage where they controlled a quarter of the world's population. I think they controlled something like a quarter of the world's landmass, or a fifth, depending on how you count it. They controlled one continent, one subcontinent, and dozens of states, principalities, dominions, and protectorates. And it ranged right away from the Arctic Circle of Canada down to the sweating, sweltering rainforests of Tasmania, and from the Falklands to Fiji. So it's a vast, it was the biggest empire the world has ever seen. And what especially fascinated me is with how they managed to do it with so few people. For instance, in India, 1,000 civil service servants, English civil servants, controlled 300 million Indians, which works out at a staggering total of one person controlling 300,000 people, each of those people. At one stage, India was controlled by something like 45,000 English troops, again, against a population of several hundred million. The big question is how they managed to do this, and there's all sorts of answers to that. The consensus up to about 10 years ago, at least in Britain and in America, some European countries, not so much in Ireland, was that they did it because they were great leaders, great delegators, they were great at organising things, as particularly transport, and that although their influence was mostly benign. And the argument, which I dispute in the book, is that that they had the occasional massacre, which could be attributed to a commander gone rogue. They had made horrendous mistakes, like the handling of the Irish famine, but that could be regarded as a blip in a sort of otherwise benign landscape. But the alternative perspective, which has been growing to the majority view recently, is that it wasn't a question of allowing people to do their own thing and benignly looking on. It was through a regime of state terror, countless daily subjugations, microaggressions, and whenever there was a least hint of a rebellion or a rising, any threat to their authority, they would have a devastating overreaction. And this process was known at the time as frightfulness, which has a completely different meaning today, but at the time it was a very serious word, meaning infliction of daily terror to keep the population more or less terrified to do anything, to stop any rebellions even before they got started. My contention is in this book is that they learned how to do this in their first colony, which was Ireland. They learned all the black arts of divide and conquer, using other people's armies to conquer territories.
You mentioned earlier the idea of going to war for the right to sell drugs, and that's a reference to the Opium Wars. Tell me about those wars, because that's maybe a part of the story of the British Empire that will be less familiar to our listeners.
Well, yeah, and it should be more familiar, because it's strange to think that throughout the history of the British Empire, you've the things that they made their money out of were things like tobacco, rum, human trafficking, and finally narcotics. And it's amazing to think that at one stage the British were the biggest narco traders in the world, and they had huge armies to enforce their muscle in this. What happened was that we had Britain wanted lots of tea from China. This is in the late 1700s, 1800s, and people couldn't get enough tea in England. They relied on the tax of tea from tea to finance the Royal Navy. But the trouble was that China didn't want anything back from Britain, or very little back from Britain. So they resolved that problem, the British, by exporting opium, which grew like weeds, the opium poppy in Bengal in India. And they were able to, through third parties, they were able to take this opium to China. And it got more and more popular there. The price went down until in the early 1800s, it got to a stage where they were flooding the Chinese market with cheap opium. It became a victim of its own success. At one stage, the emperor said, that's enough, we're going to ban the trade. But Britain couldn't do this because by that stage, they'd got to rely so much on money from opium. It actually financed India. I think it was something like a sixth of the finances of India came from opium. And as a result, they had to act to stop this happening. And things reached a head when in 1839, when the Chinese seized 1,400 tons of opium from British traders and destroyed it. Now, there was a sort of bit of negotiation beforehand. The British representative agreed to compensate the dealers for this, which was a huge sort of step forward, because for the first time, before the British had been trying to keep, the establishment had been trying to keep clean hands of all this dirty business. But now, for a brief period, they owned this 1,400 tonnes of opium before it was destroyed, which made it the biggest narco trader in history. So what happened? The British suddenly owed 2 million to opium traders. A huge amount of money in those days, didn't want to pay it, so they went to war for the right to trade this opium to China, and they went full in. Now, the trouble was, the interesting thing was that it was very unpopular war, and it only, the right to go to war was only voted in by a sliver of a majority. But they went to war, and the commander-in-chief, strangely enough, was a man from Limerick, from Enniscrottie in Limerick, called Hugh Gough. And he was a very experienced soldier. His background is interesting. He came in from a military family, but he was never given former tutelage, just like his brothers were. And he only learned his education from eavesdropping on the tutors. But he shot up the ranks of the military ranks, went in hard there. The British had ironclad ships and Congreve rockets, missiles, and they were able to just roll all over the Chinese junks who were trying to fight them. They went upriver. It was mostly a naval campaign, bombarded villages. And there was one very unequal battle where 2,000 Chinese died for something like three British casualties. And there were a lot of atrocities, rape, looting. But finally, the Chinese were reduced to their knees and forced to sign an unequal treaty, as they described it. The British got Hong Kong, and after another war later on, they got the right to sell opium, which they took full advantage of and used it to finance India right up until the early part of the 1900s.
Incredible. You also explore how biowarfare was considered by the British for use in North America against the Native Americans and as a way of gaining a foothold and a supremacy there.
Yes, indeed. This was something that shocked me. I wasn't aware of at all. Now, obviously, the British didn't invent biowarfare. This had been going on since ancient times. But the scenario is it's 1763 in Fort Pitt, Pennsylvania, where Pittsburgh is today. The governor of North America, Jeffrey Amherst, decided that the best way to get rid of the Native Americans who were in his way as he tried to expand English influence was to infect them with smallpox, against which the indigenous people had very little defence. So he actually sent a letter marked on His Majesty's service, ordering his generals to infect the Native Americans with smallpox through vectors like dirty hankies and blankets from smallpox hospitals. And he clearly stated his intention as to eradicate the population. So the genocidal intent was there. Now, a little before that, there was a Captain William Trent in Fort Pitt, which was beleaguered by a siege of Indians. And he received a peace delegation from a Delaware Indians, two Delaware delegates. And he gave them a blanket or two blankets and a hanky infected with smallpox from the local hospital, hoping that they would spread this throughout their tribe and that they that there would be thousands of deaths and that they would win the war just without hardly a shot being fired at that stage. And the two delegates took it back to their tribe. There was a smallpox outbreak after that, but it's impossible to tell whether it was linked to that particular incident. Nobody will ever know. But it was a coincidence. The incredible thing about it is that Captain William Trent, who sent these blankets to the Native Americans, actually filled out an expenses form afterwards, like some Whitehall civil servant, saying quite clearly this was to claiming money to convey smallpox to the Indians. And it was approved by a general. And this was one of the oddest, the document still exists, and one of the funniest and yet most sinister documents in the archives of British Empire, in my opinion.
Where did it all go wrong for the empire then? Empires rise, empires fall. But given it had achieved such a dominant position, what was the cause of its downfall?
The empire reached its peak around the end of the First World War, when Britain had got some territories from Germany, mostly in Africa. So at that stage, it became a bit unwieldy, and it also became a bit unfashionable after the First World War. the idea of subjugating peoples became the idea of slavery. Now, slavery still existed right up into in Sierra Leone in Africa under British rule right up into the 1920s. But mostly it was the cost, I think, of fighting two world wars. Secondly, the cost of fighting against fascism in the Second World War. And they were pretty broke. They couldn't continue to finance India. They couldn't, and the Japanese, the success of the Japanese armies in Asia during the Second World War destroyed the myth of British supremacy. And there was a shift of attitudes too in Britain. Nobody wanted, the empire was regarded as quite fuddy-duddy, Victorian. And they just really wanted out as easily as they could. And it was the same with other empires. The French were the same, they and the Belgians, they just wanted out with as little trouble as possible. The trouble is that in India, certainly, they didn't get out clean. They got out cleanly without many British casualties, but they partitioned India in a rush, giving very little time and thought to what would happen. They didn't even disclose the partition line until after they'd got cleanly out. And the violence that followed in the creation of India and Pakistan was horrendous. I think something a million people died and 15 million displaced, something like that. Still, of course, control territories overseas. And the interesting thing is that the current Foreign and Commonwealth Minister, David Lammy, in Keir Starmer's government, is descended from former slaves in British Guiana. So it's a sort of nice closing of a circle there.
Well, it's an important new book, The Brutish Empire, Four Centuries of Colonial Atrocities. It's published in paperback by the O'Brien Press. The author, Des Eakin. And Des, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. Dublin, the capital of Ireland, and to some at least the second city of the empire, was central to the Irish Revolution. The city was a hub for the development of the suffrage and republican movements, and it also witnessed the largest industrial dispute in the history of the island in 1913. The bulk of the fighting at Easter 1916, and some of the most famous and infamous moments of the War of Independence and Civil War. And the story has now been retold in a brilliant new book, Dublin, the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press. The author is Brian Hughes. And Brian, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
So, Brian, can I begin with maybe some of the less well-known parts of this story, including the role that we see in the story of organised unionism, because there was an Ulster Day in Dublin in 1912.
Yeah, it was one of the things that really struck me when I was looking into the book. And I suppose I had the challenge of trying to tell the story that people are familiar with, but also adding new elements or new perspectives. And organised unionism is remarkably prominent. It is a minority and it's restricted by the fact that it's a minority. But I was particularly struck by the scale of organisation, the activism. Ultimately, it was all for nothing because they didn't get what they wanted. But there were unionist clubs in Dublin. There were two in Kingstown, as they called it, later became Dunleary. And Dublin was one of the places outside of Ulster where signings were held on Ulster Day in September 1912. So Ulster Day was the day when men and women signed the Solemn League and Covenant and the Women's Declaration to declare their opposition to Home Rule. And in Dublin, the Irish Unionist Alliance facilitated signings and their offices in Grafton Street. It was for Ulster folk, those with Ulster heritage, Ulster lineage, who were either living in Dublin or who were travelling through Dublin. But it was in the context of a minority position. It was a big event in the city, and I think says a lot about the range of opinion and perspectives that existed in the city during the revolutionary period.
Talk to me about the 1916 Rising, because we might think that after everything that's been written and said about 1916, that there isn't something new that can be said or a new angle. But you do find a new angle because you tell the story from the point of view of the ordinary men and women who are there when the fighting breaks out. So it is a very different perspective and a different angle and a different kind of camera view of it.
I think what I tried to do with that chapter, bearing in mind there is so much written about the Easter Rising and it's such a well-known story, was to think about the Rising not as something that happened in Dublin, but what it did to Dublin. So how it impacted people who lived in Dublin who were caught completely unawares by this outbreak of revolution on their doorstep. The widespread destruction of large chunks of the city, the loss of life, the disruption just to daily life, access to food, transport, access to work, to workplaces, you know, to pensions, and how people responded in the immediacy of the event, how they wrote about it. And there are quite a number of surviving accounts written at the time. So nowadays we might take out our camera phone and record something. What people did then, if they had the means to do so, was they wrote about what was happening around them. So people started to write diaries who hadn't been writing them before. Other people wrote a letter to somebody to say, look at this big thing that's happening around us. And because they couldn't post a letter on Easter Monday, they kept adding to it. So it ends up becoming this week-long blow-by-blow account of what was going on around them. And it points to all sorts of things that we don't necessarily think about with the rising, which is the fact that people couldn't get bread. The price of bread went up. Food became difficult to access. The excitement of it as well as the danger. People living in the Southside townships, very keen to go into the city to see what was going on and actually to put themselves in harm's way in trying to do so. The looting comes out very strongly in these accounts. It seems to be a real pivotal part of the rising for lots of people. It was something done by other people, not by the rioters themselves. But also I think changes the timeline of the rising a little bit as well. So these people living in the Southside townships, they're not talking about the GPO or the proclamation. It's the occupation of Weston Row train station or Stephen's Green on the south side of the city. For them, the rising didn't end with the surrender of all of the garrisons at, you know, over Saturday and Sunday following Easter Monday. It was actually in the days afterwards when the trams started running again, or when letters started being posted again, or where they could go back to work. And actually you can see lots of accounts where there are potshots being taken. There were clearly some rebels who decided not to surrender, and they're on roofs or at windows taking potshots for days after the official surrender had happened. So if you look at the rising from the perspective of those people who had no control over it, I think it changes a lot of aspects of how we think about it.
What's interesting about the book as well is it doesn't just focus on Dublin City, it's also Dublin County, and that maybe there is a tendency among historians that when they talk about what's happening in Dublin, they only talk about the city. And by looking at the whole county, you do get a different perspective.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. If we think of Dublin now, there are lots of different Dublins. I'm from kind of West Dublin, you know, it's very different to South Dublin in many ways, often very different to North County Dublin. And that was the case then as well. And if you look at the War of Independence, for example, there wasn't one War of Independence in Dublin, really. There were lots of different Wars of Independence dictated by geography, by the makeup of the local IRA, by the distribution of the Crown forces. You know, you have a number of army barracks just south of the river. North County Dublin, there was Gormanston Barracks. And, you know, you have rural North County Dublin had a very, very different war to the urban war that you saw in Dublin City. What they were able to do, what the IRA were able to achieve was different. You know, there were complaints about North County Dublin at various points. They had a very testy relationship with General Headquarters. And General Headquarters controlled the whole war, but was based in the city. And so that did impact the Dublin IRA because, you know, the officer commanding the Dublin Brigade sat on GHQ. But that wasn't the case for the Fingal Brigade. So Fingal had its own separate brigade. Its OC had a lot of criticism. He complained he was being hamstrung. They complained he wasn't doing very much. Whereas actually in South County Dublin, you'd Andy MacDonald, very, very active, proactive. Again, limits on what they could achieve given the very strong military and police presence in South Dublin, but very keen just to take pot shots at, you know, the Crown forces. And actually for a lot of Dublin, it wasn't about big victories. It was just about staying in the fight. I mean, that was very much the case in the city, but it was also the case in the South County. It wasn't taking a barracks. It was being seen to shoot at it that really mattered. Whereas in North County Dublin, this very flat terrain, the chance that the auxiliary division can arrive on top of you from Gormanstown at any minute. And there were rows in North County Dublin as well about levels of activity and what they should be doing. GHQ were keen for certain parts of Dublin to be used as safe havens. You don't want to draw too much attention to the North County so that men in the city can get out of trouble if they need to. And all of this stuff is all happening at the same time. Sometimes it's conflicting with each other. And so lots of mini wars going on in different parts of Dublin.
How big is the civil war then in Dublin, city and county?
Yeah, on the one hand, you might look at the civil war in Dublin and think, well, it's a week. It's the battle for Dublin after the attack on the forecourts that lasted about a week, ended with the anti-treatyites essentially fleeing the city. And it's very easy to look at the civil war then and think, well, it moved elsewhere. You see, you go from the conventional phase to the guerrilla phase and the focus moves down to Munster in particular. But actually, the civil war carried on in Dublin City in other ways. It was just a different type of war after the Battle for Dublin, which was this big week-long set-piece battle, a bit like Easter week, actually, in some respects. But in the months that followed and right up into 1923, the violence of the civil war carried on. There were assassinations, there were shootings. The Criminal Investigation Department, based in Oriel House, was particularly notorious in Dublin. Young men were being taken in off the streets and found shot dead. There were a number of killings then, even beyond the official end of the civil war as well. You know, November 1923, two Jewish men were killed in the city, which caused some concern and some controversy. And even beyond what happened in Dublin for the remainder of the civil war, Dubliners were quite prominent elsewhere. Some of the most notorious events of the Civil War in Kerry, for example, were led by Dubliners. Paddy O'Daly, for example, who was in command of the National Army in Kerry, very heavily responsible for the Ballyseedy massacre and other atrocities carried out down there. Some of the victims of the violence in Kerry were also Dubliners who joined the National Army and then had been posted down to Kerry. So the Civil War impacted on Dublin in all sorts of ways, even when Dublin wasn't the focal point of the Civil War anymore.
You also have a new take on the 1913 lockout. And again, that's such a central moment in the history of worker relations on the island. And it's such a massive dispute. And maybe perhaps we maybe don't fully recognise just how significant it was.
Yes, it was a huge event while it was happening. This huge industrial dispute that impacted widely across working class Dublin in particular. People's livelihoods were put on hold, essentially. So it caused huge amounts of hardship. It resonated beyond Dublin. You know, there's interaction between what's happening in Dublin and, you know, the British Trade Union Council. But actually it went beyond the city as well. And that's one thing that is easily forgotten. We think of the lockout and naturally enough, we think of the city again. But actually there were disputes, agricultural labourers on strike or being locked out of work in County Dublin, North and South County Dublin. And those kind of disputes actually carried on for years afterwards. So the county was impacted as well as the city. But it had a long afterlife, I think, as well in the memory of Dubliners. So one of the things I was struck by looking at accounts of the Easter Rising, to bring the discussion back to the Easter Rising, was how often people referred to tropes or images or terms that you would associate with the lockout, the citizen army being called Larkinites, people who were known for the lockout being recognised in a way that maybe some Irish volunteer leaders weren't. So it again is huge while it's happening, but had a long afterlife as well. And it created a lot of bitterness. I think attitudes towards the Dublin Metropolitan Police in Dublin were very heavily influenced by what had happened at the lockout. And they were changed to some extent by the lockout. Some of the early victims of the Easter Rising, again, were members of the Dublin Metropolitan Police killed by members of the Irish Citizen Army. And it's hard to disconnect that fully from what had happened a few years ago and the bitterness towards the Dublin Metropolitan Police in working class Dublin.
There was a strike against militarism in April 1922. It's quite dramatic there in terms of some of the things that we see happening.
Yeah, it's another one of these really large kind of national events that is centred around Dublin, an effort to combat violence. You know, by that point, as we have to imagine that Dublin has been through several years of violence and conflict. And while the split over the Anglo-Irish Treaty was going on, there's an awful lot of people who, whatever they think about the Anglo-Irish Treaty, they don't want to go back to war. And this is this large-scale effort to sort of find an alternative to going back for war, to reject the violence, perhaps, in some respects. There's a lot more to it than that, but it's in one way it tells you something about how people were thinking. But it also comes on, it's a long tradition of these large scale strikes or events in protest or in support of events that were going on.
Yeah, there's that one against militarism, but then there's also the occupation of the Rotunda Concert Hall in January, I think it's 22, and the young novelist Liam O'Flaherty is there and they're flying the red flag for 4 days. That there are these attempts to make points that are perhaps being forgotten about in the political debates and discussions.
Yeah, and O'Flaherty's group is very easily forgotten and actually wasn't very widely popular at the time either. And some of the kind of complexities of attitudes and perspectives in Dublin emerge in that. So, you know, the strike against militarism was in some ways a very different event to what O'Flaherty was doing. There were crowds showing up to protest against O'Flaherty and what he was doing. People concerned about Bolshevism, the flying of the red flag, scared some people. And, you know, rather than the message of about unemployment, which is one of the things that was at the forefront of this, people are looking at this in the context of the Russian Revolution or the context of fears around socialism or Bolshevism. So some people who might have supported the strike on militarism were very much opposed to what O'Flaherty was trying to do. And so crowds are gathering in Dublin all the time to protest, to mourn, to celebrate. And, you know, you'd love to see the Venn diagram of the people who show up at these different events, how many people are showing up at events that might actually be contradictory in terms of the message, because people's ideas are changing, the perspectives are changing, they're picking and choosing what they want to support or what they want to protest against.
In terms of, I suppose, the wave of new research and the wave of new archival material after the, during and after the decade of centenaries, it has enabled us to get new perspectives on what's happened throughout the country over that crucial decade.
Yeah, one of the obvious places where we can see this huge growth in material that we've access to is the Military Service Pensions Collection. And that tells us so much about what happened in different parts of the country during the revolutionary period. It, for example, highlights a huge amount of the work that women did, the activism that women did that is otherwise ignored in other places. Even in the Bureau of Military History, there's lots of stuff coming out in the pensions collection that isn't in the Bureau of Military History, which was one of the key sources for the last 10 or 15 years. But it also tells us a huge amount about the afterlives of the revolution as well and how the revolution impacted on people, dependents of those who were killed, men and women who suffered loss of employment, injury. I'm very struck, for example, by the case of Seamus Grace, who was in Northumberland Road on Easter week. He survived. Michael Malone was in the house on Northumberland Road, but then was killed. And by the 1930s, Seamus Grace was unable to work. He'd had all of his teeth extracted. He'd lost the use of his leg. He'd become active again during the War of Independence and was shot in the leg. He was deemed to be at 100% disability. He had tremors. He had paranoia. He had insomnia. You know, from the 1923 onwards, he couldn't work, couldn't hold down an ordinary life, spent a period in Grange Gorman mental institution and died in 1959, having had a very difficult couple of decades. And there are stories like that all over a source like the Military Service Pensions Collection, and you can see the historiography is really starting to pick up on that, the various ways that that collection in particular can change how we think about the period.
Well, it's an important new book. It's called Dublin, the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923, published in paperback by the Four Courts Press. The author is Brian Hughes. And Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.